I getting through to you?
Am I getting through to you? Am I getting the message out to you? Am I getting through to you and your crew? Do you understand what you've got to do? You've got to wake up, take up an issue.
Now that was DJ Rubbish exhorting us to take up an issue. As an example of what that could mean, I was in conversation last week with an old friend of mine who reported back a discussion about plans to extend the life of a nuclear power plant in the area, and there was a lot of apparently well-meaning people discussing what they should do about this because they didn't want it to happen, and his comment was very simple. He said, look, a lot of money wants this nuclear power plant to happen, and we don't, so if push comes to shove and we demonstrate about this, we are likely to get put in prison. And if we're not ready to do that, then we can just pack up and go home because we're wasting our time. And almost everybody else at the meeting just chose to ignore that comment and carried on with ideas about waving placards, getting people to sign petitions, and basically begging the powers that be to think again. And only a single person said, yes, you're absolutely right, and you've cut through a lot of wasted time to face the critical issue. A quick look at the fundamental social changes which have occurred will reveal they have not been caused in the main by people who were concerned, but only up to a point, only up to the point at which their well-being was under threat, especially in the current setup, in which the money system works as a terrible divide-and-conquer matrix, in which those who don't have access to credit creation are kept through debt in a perpetual struggle for the same limited artificial resource, I suggest that fundamental change is not possible within this system. Thinking, for example, about Dr. Martin Luther King and the civil rights struggle in the US, those people were beaten, sometimes violently attacked by police, certainly sent to jail a lot of times, put a lot of pressure on the court system, and while the intent of those who were opposing them was to prevent others from following their example, at some point the patent injustice of what was going on actually became counterproductive. They said, look, we can't do it this way anymore, we actually have to change, we've got to concede a point. Now, this seems to be what DJ Rubbish is saying when he says take up an issue. An ever larger number of dispossessed people, particularly in the so-called developing world, are facing the harsh reality of not getting enough food, not having a place to live, or other real hardships. How many people, correspondingly part of the oppressive capitalist machine, are not facing real hardships, but facing perceived hardships, whether that is going without a DVD player or a holiday, or facing the threat of losing their job? Their hardship is mental of a kind, it's stress-related, looking at the fact that they have perhaps decades of conditioning about how things ought to be, or what it means to be a good person, loyalty to one's company, one's country, or whatever, a mental patterning which makes it hard for them to step outside of their programmed pattern of behaviour and to follow their heart, to really pursue an issue because it's the right thing to do. Now, by way of encouragement, let's hear from two people who were in this situation and stepped into the unknown because they felt they should. We're going to start with Charles Eisenstein, author of A Scent of Humanity. This is an interview with Marie Levitt from 2010.
I'm not really sure if I consciously stepped up to take life by the horns. Really what it was for me was that living in the way I had been living just became so intolerable that I almost had no choice but to live in a different way. And I think that birth is kind of like that. And when people are successful, they like to credit themselves with it. But maybe it's like birth, in which the baby only does maybe 1% of the work. And life circumstances, when we've grown enough in our old selves, in our old world, life circumstances birth us into the new thing. So I just wanted to preface it with that, and then I can explain or I can tell about how it happened to me. as a teenager, I had a very strong sense that there was something wrong with the world, especially something wrong with the life that had been offered to me or the world as it had been offered to me as normal. And so I had this voice inside, this feeling that said, this can't be normal. This can't be right. I can't put up with this. This is wrong. It's supposed to be better. It's supposed to be more beautiful. It's supposed to be more exciting.
What exactly were those things that felt wrong to you? Teenagers usually is the age where they think that many things are wrong. Everything's wrong with their
yeah.
life. So, but I feel that in your case, it was different. It was deeper. It was on a much deeper level.
Actually, I think that most teenagers are tapping into something very true when they
right.
when they think that everything's wrong. Like school, for example. I mean, that's a dominant fact in most teenagers' lives. And, you know, is it right that you sit in a classroom for 50 minutes learning what you're told is important, and then you have 4 minutes to get to the next class, and then 4 minutes to get to the one after that, and each one is disconnected from the other ones, and you don't get to follow whatever passions you have, and you have 30 minutes to eat lunch, and you're not allowed outdoors. I mean, you know, there's we could go on and on about that. So I think that even the average teenager is more tuned in to the wrongness than most adults are, you know, because eventually it's almost like we get broken to it. And so that was one thing, just like the normal everyday feeling like this can't be right, the petty humiliations of school. But another thing that played into it was that my father had given me all these books in my early teenage years that made it crystal clear that something was wrong with the world. He gave me Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, mm-hmm. which was written in, I think, in like 1962. And it was like the first wake-up call about the state of the environment and how we were polluting it. He gave me Gulag Archipelago about the prison camps in Russia. He gave me A People's History of the United States, which is basically a far-left account of United States history that turns everything on its head. You know, oh, George Washington wasn't a good guy after all. And so all of these influences made it impossible for me to fully participate in the life that had been offered to me. And like a lot of people, and this is really common in my generation, in the previous generation, the baby boom generation, you could still get excited about the way things were going. Science had achieved all these great triumphs, and we were going to move onward and upward to the stars and conquer disease and all this kind of stuff. And you could still believe in that growing up in the 50s and 60s. We're going to conquer poverty, conquer racism. But by the time I came of age, you could no longer believe that humanity was on the right track and the world was getting better and better. There was just, the wrongness was just too obvious. So like many people in my generation, I was unable to wholeheartedly participate. And different ones of us resisted the program in different ways. For some people, it's depression. They withdraw from life. Other people, it's addiction. Other people just kind of get lazy and they become slackers and procrastinate or just make a half-hearted effort.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more of me. You know, I made kind of a half-hearted effort to go along with things, but my heart wasn't in it. You know, I went to Taiwan after college, and first I worked in a bar. And then eventually I started doing translation, but I never really tried to be a big success because I was not that interested in being a big success. I couldn't really believe in it. I remember one time, here's another key moment. I was about 27, I think, and I was at a meeting. And by this time, I was doing business translation and any translation, actually, and helping companies localize their products into the, you know, English-speaking markets and stuff. And there I was in a meeting, and some people were discussing some new software feature that was upcoming and how it would affect their product and how it would affect their competitors. And it was something like 3D sound or something like that. I can't remember what it was exactly. But everybody in the room was so excited about it, you know? And I thought, hold on. You mean you guys are actually excited about this? You actually care about this trivial feature, which isn't really going to change anything in the world? I only care about it because I'm paid to care about it. I don't care about it for real. So I felt like this moment of superiority, you know, this kind of cynical, superior feeling. But then the next feeling was a kind of panic because I thought, my goodness, I don't care about this. I don't care about anything except what I'm paid to care about. When in this lifetime do I get to do something that I care about for real? So when do I get to live my life and not the life I'm paid to live? Like, what about my life? Do I get to have that? And that thought was so alarming to me that once I had it, even more, I was just going through the motions in my work, and I just didn't care. And I knew I didn't care. And it wasn't long after that that I left that work, moved away from the country, from Taiwan, where I had been living, and that environment which reinforced all of my habits and routines. And I just moved with my young family to America with no job, but I just had to get away from it because I just couldn't take it. It was excruciating.
Well, you know, this question that you asked, when will I get to do something that I really care about rather than something I'm paid for? And actually now you're doing something you care about and you are paid for it. And that's my point. You can do things you care about and get paid for them, right?
Yes. And sometimes it's a long journey to find that, though, because most of the roles that are offered for pay are things that no sane human being would really care about very much.
So you have to create something on your own. You have to create a job for yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what you're doing today, I don't think it was available anywhere on the market. You just created it, and you're doing it right now.
Well, I mean, I knew, you know, when I started writing books, I knew that there's such a thing as an author and that some authors make a living at it. Very, very few, actually, but that it's possible. So for a while, I was trying to make a living as an author and doing the things that I thought one had to do to make that work, and it didn't work. When I was doing it, even if there was 10% of me that was saying, I'm doing this to make a living, it wasn't working. It was only when I gave up on that and decided I'm just going to do what I want to do, only then did I start to make a living at it.
So if I understand correctly, you live your life with this attitude of you do nothing to make a living out of it. So there is no you don't have this goal of surviving, of
right,
making money. So you have food tomorrow. You just do what you want to do, and you're provided.
Yeah, I don't do anything because of the money. I only do things because I want to do them. And I'm not saying that it's wrong to do things because of the money. I mean, I did come to a point where actually a couple of years ago where I thought, you know, we're going to be hungry. Me and my children, we're going to be hungry if this
mm-hmm.
keeps up.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to ask myself, at what point will I just do something for the money? And the realization I had was that I will do that if and when my children are actually hungry and I'm not just projecting that, you know, if things keep going the way they are, they will be hungry. So even when I was totally broke, I had this 50-pound bag of rice, you know, in my house and some food from my brother who's a farmer. We never went hungry, not even once, even though it looked pretty grim. We never actually went hungry. And so I never actually had to do something that I didn't want to do. But I don't think there's anything – I mean, this isn't about being pure and being good and being virtuous and not soiling my hands with things that I just do for money. But – right now, it's true that I don't do anything just for the money.
You're talking about being broke. How did you get there? Here you got to the United States from Taiwan with your family, and then what? How did you get from that point to being broke?
There were many years in between. For a while, when I was still married, my wife was a real estate agent, and I didn't know what I wanted to do in life. And there were some, you know, relationship dynamics involved here, too, that I won't go into. But basically, I didn't know what I wanted to do, and she did. So I stayed home with the kids and started writing books. But mostly, I was just home with the kids. And that went on for a while until at one point, the marriage fell apart, and she stopped doing real estate. And I was, you know, even more busy writing books. But I wasn't making enough money at all. And things got worse and worse. I went bankrupt, you know. I mean, I tried many things. I tried teaching yoga. I tried a lot of things before I found what I really want to do.
And I know that after divorce, the kids stayed with you. So all that situation was with kids. You had three kids when you got broke, right?
Yeah, that's right. I was pretty much a single dad with three kids.
Wow.
But what I was really afraid of, I mean, when it comes right down to it, my fear wasn't really of starving or of physical deprivation. My fear was more of the humiliation of having to ask people for help and to receive help even, and it's tied into a fear of fully receiving. And a lot of people are hesitant to receive gifts because when you receive a gift, then you are in a state of obligation toward either that person or toward the community or toward the universe. People today, they want to stay free of obligation, independent. To me, that's anti-life, you know, to remain free of obligations.
Why is it obligation and why people resist it? Because receiving gifts seems like such a nice thing. You know, I think when you say receiving gifts, I imagine a birthday party. And here everybody is coming, bringing a gift. You know, why would you have resistance to that?
Well, the way that gifts work, and a lot of the thinking I do is about the gift, is that gifts come from a feeling of gratitude. When we feel gratitude, we desire to give. And gratitude is the knowledge of having received a gift and the desire to give in turn. So when we receive gifts, even if the person has no intention of getting something back, at least I feel like I want to give back. It's a kind of an obligation. You know, today we have this ideal of financial independence, which really means I don't need anybody because I can pay for it. I don't need anybody's gifts. I don't need anybody's goodwill. I'm independent. And this, we elevate this as some kind of paradise to be attained. But when people actually achieve it, they find that it's no paradise at all because they have no community then. They don't need anybody, but no one really needs them either. And if somebody disappears, if I'm financially independent and the farmer who grows my food or the cashier in the supermarket who rings it up or my doctor or my anything, if they died, then that's okay. I can pay someone else to do it. I don't need them. And by the same token, in a specialized money-based society, no one needs us either, so we're replaceable too. And that's why community is so hard to create today if you have money. Because anytime you gather together, there's an unspoken realization of, I don't need you. How can you really have community if that's the underlying knowledge?
So you think that community, I'm hearing you. You think that we have difficulty in creating communities because of money?
Yes, absolutely. Because community is woven from gifts. Because gifts create obligation, they create gratitude.
Do you see a possibility for creating community in which people do have money and they share gifts and they open with it?
Yeah, although if you have plenty of money and you give somebody gifts that could be bought with money, then you're not really giving them something that they need uniquely from you because they could just go buy it. Now, you could create community with the things that money cannot buy. Although today, more and more things are purchased with money that were once part of a gift economy. For example, wise advice and a shoulder to cry on. People never used to pay for that, but now they go to their therapist or their life coach or something like that, and they pay for what was once free. Another example would be childcare, which even when I was a kid, that's something people rarely paid for. It was very normal for neighbors to watch each other's kids after school. But now it's like, oh, you want me to watch your kids so that you don't have to pay a daycare center? You know, and you kind of feel like if you ask your neighbors to watch your kids, you kind of feel like, oh, maybe I should pay them something, you know. But what the payment does is it erases the tie or the connection that would be formed if it had been a gift. If I give my neighbor the gift of childcare, then there's kind of an expectation, or you could say it's an expectation that he will someday give me something, or it could just be a feeling that persists in him that he wants to do something because he's received. In a real community, the person you give to might not be the same person who gives back to you. You might give to somebody.
That's an amazing idea. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you can still, anyway, to just get back to your question, you know, you can still create gatherings, and if there's something left that cannot be bought for money, then you can still create community out of it. But I've just been to so many things where we're like, okay, we're going to create a community, you know, and then people just don't come to the next one. So let's set up a listserv. Let's email each other, you know, and community just doesn't happen, and it's because people don't need each other as individual specific people.
You know, I really, really love this idea that you just explained. expressed about unity of the universe, I think it's impossible to really believe that way, that the person you give to not necessarily will be the person you receive from. Mm-hmm. I think that that approach is only possible if you see, if you experience everything, you know, from oneness, from that place,
yeah.
If you know that the universe is a united kind of being and you're a part of it, and so you can give someone, or someone can give to you, and you can give to someone else, and that it doesn't matter energetically, it's the same thing. Even when you give to yourself, it's still the same connection. It's really beautiful. So all these wonderful ideas about receiving, and I understand that today you know how to receive, you've learned how to receive, and you teach people how to receive. But I want to take you back to that point in your life where you didn't know how to receive. And when you said that the scariest part for you was when you were broke and you had kids with you, the scariest part for you was to ask people for help. Was that the moment in your life where you actually had that shift of into who you are today, that shift of being able to ask for help? And if you have some examples of actually asking for help and realizing that this is a wonderful thing, because
yeah.
I'm sure there are many people listening now who have problem to ask for help. I had a big problem asking for help myself for years and years. You know, so if you can reflect
yeah.
on how the shift happened for you.
Yeah. I don't think there was one defining moment, but there were some pretty important realizations. One of the realizations was that when I, in the past, had asked for help, I kind of did it from this very subtle victim mentality that said, I need help, and you really should give me help because I've suffered so much and I really deserve it. So you're kind of obligated to give me help. And I wasn't actually giving people a chance to be generous. It's like if you say, like, okay, I needed a place to stay. I was asked to leave a place I had been staying, and I had almost no money to pay for anything. And I ended up, the way it happened was really easy. It was so easy. I just mentioned to my chiropractor that I needed a place to stay. And he said, oh, I know these people. They have a place called River Sanctuary, and they're looking for a new housemate or something. And so I ended up living with them they didn't really charge rent. They just asked me to share expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in the past, I would have felt uncomfortable with receiving what was really a gift, right? That, by letting me live there with no rent, that's a gift. And mm-hmm. in the past, I would have tried to deactivate the gift by essentially saying either to them or just to myself, well, you know, I've had such bad luck, and I've been so good, I've been trying so hard, and nothing's worked out, and poor me, and therefore, I don't need to feel gratitude for this gift, because I deserved it. I was entitled to it.
You deserved it because of your suffering.
Right. And that was what, in the past, I would have done to give myself permission to receive and to excuse myself from feeling gratitude. If you think, oh, I just deserve that anyway, then there's no reason for gratitude and no call to give in return.
Mm-hmm.
And that attitude is actually what blocks the incoming flow of gifts. It's called begging, actually, where, you know, on some level you're trying to hook the other person's pity.
And it usually triggers sacrificial attitude in these people. Usually they
mm-hmm.
do it from the place of sacrificing something.
Yeah, right. And there's a whole psychological dynamic that goes along with that. But just for me on the personal level, it was very freeing to allow people to be generous. And it was scary because it called on me to do that too, to be generous too. And it's a very different way of living. And like, I'm no master at it. I'm still getting used to it, in fact, and I still discover subtle ways in which I'm begging. And when I discover mm-hmm. them, I feel uncomfortable about them. I usually, well, it's actually the discomfort that cues me in to them. And then, you know, I go through a process where I choose to no longer do that.
So you allowed people to be generous towards you and you felt gratitude. What did you do? Was it a new feeling for you, that feeling of free, kind of free gratitude, not out of obligation, but just out of pure gratitude?
Let me see if I can give you a concrete example. I lead retreats and seminars and things, and I run them on a gift basis so that people will just pay, you know, the hard cost, room and board, and usually I include my travel expenses in there so that at least I'm breaking even. I'm not subsidizing the other people's experience, but I'm not charging them for it either. And then on top of that, if they feel gratitude for what I've given, then you can give me a gift in return. And that's very clear. It's very, there's no begging in that. But sometimes I notice that I'll try to insinuate into it a little hint of how I've sacrificed and how I've suffered and therefore how they should give me more. And then I'm not trusting on their gratitude. I'm actually appealing to their guilt. And it doesn't feel good. When I notice the ways in which I'm doing that, it doesn't feel good. And ultimately, it is counterproductive. It actually limits the flow of gifts. So I'm learning not to do that. And I want to say also that there's a kind of a mystery around the gift, that when you give a gift, you don't know how the return gift will come. It may come from the person you gave it to. It may come from the community that witnessed the gift that you gave that person, either because it was public or because they told somebody about it. But it might come in mysterious ways just from the universe, that and there's no logical connection, but you just somehow feel that you're being thanked. It's something I'm just learning about right now. Like I said, I mean, I'm not an expert in this. There are many people who have lived in the gift much more deeply than I have for decades and decades.
When you're talking about gratitude and give it back, and is there a difference between the feeling of gratitude that you're talking about and feeling of, I just think about myself in the past, you know, when somebody would give me something, I immediately felt that I had to give something to them. And that was not necessarily a feeling of gratitude, that was a feeling of breaking even, kind of.
Yeah, that's right. That's actually a way of cutting off gratitude. If you give a return gift too quickly, then it's almost like an exchange, and it's saying, we're even now. Sometimes when someone gives me the gift of a compliment, I notice myself doing that. Instead of really accepting it, because sometimes it's a big compliment, you know, someone might tell me something really moving and personal and for example, that my words have changed their life or something like that. And I've discovered that I have these subtle ways of refusing that gift. One is to say thank you too quickly without really meaning it. Another is to say, you know, you would have received that message one way or another. I was just the instrument. Kind of false humility. Mm-hmm. For me to really take it in, sometimes it's big. I mean, sometimes it's hard to take in something that big. So I do notice myself doing what you just said, like this wanting to give a return gift so quickly that there's no feeling of having received. There's only a feeling of having made an exchange and now we're even and now I don't have to have anything to do with you anymore. I don't have to have a connection. But a real gift leaves a connection. And then the return gift deepens the connection when the return gift happens. But I think it's really important to allow the receiving to sink in fully. Otherwise, it just becomes this formalized ritual of, and you're just breaking even and you're not creating a tie.
I cannot tell you how many clients I had who had problem with receiving. People feel more comfortable actually to give because
yes.
I think that puts them into a position of being in control. I also think that receiving makes you feel kind of vulnerable, very vulnerable.
Right. Yeah, because then you owe somebody something. Either you owe somebody or you owe the community or you owe the universe something.
That's what you think it is about? That's why you feel vulnerable?
Yeah, and also you feel like you're dependent. It's like being on charity or something. You're dependent then, and we consider it a virtue to be independent, to be able to pay for anything and not have to depend on somebody's gifts. But that's an illusion. We are dependent on other beings completely. We're dependent on the sun. We're dependent on the earth. We're dependent on the trees. We're dependent on society. I mean, we're totally dependent. And the only thing that the illusion of financial independence does is it makes us dependent on people we don't know instead of dependent on people we do know.
How about in terms of the universe? You know, you just mentioned the sun and the trees and all that. How about being dependent on the moment? You know, being dependent on tomorrow. Being dependent on. I found that the most difficult, probably, for the human mind is to feel dependent on the unknown. At least that's how my life looks. You know,
yeah.
I walk in trust that every day will bring something that I need, and in terms of money, in terms of relationship, in terms relationships, in terms of everything. So
yeah.
It's kind of you depend on the unknown.
Yeah. And sometimes this trust that I will receive what I need, it includes the understanding that I might not know what I need and that what I receive might not look like what I think I need. Because, like, in my life, you know, going bankrupt, that was just what I needed. But I would never have asked for it. And, in fact, most of the calamities that have happened in my life were just what I needed. So that's like the universe is so generous that it gives us even more than we know to ask for.
Even more. But when you look back on that situation of being broke and, you know, do you see it as a gift from the universe, actually?
Yeah, totally. That was such a rich experience. And it just cleaned out of me all of these false ambitions, the things that I thought I wanted but didn't really want. There's a beautiful poem in Rumi somewhere. There's a sheikh or something who it is said, he prays loud and long, blessing the thieves and robbers who beat him up and leave him for dead on the street. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because he says, they remind me that what I want isn't what they want. So I see, like, the various thieves and robbers, illness and divorce and bankruptcy and all of these things that happen to me as reminders that what I want isn't what society has conditioned me to want. I mean, there was a time where I was kind of, you know, trying to be, you know, a hotshot author and to promote myself, and my heart wasn't in it, but I kind of went through the motions, and I'm really glad that that didn't succeed and that I didn't waste years pursuing a mirage. I'm really glad that now I've been through that and I can just totally focus on the gift that delights me. I love my work, and I feel free now. Having experienced what I feared, I feel free now to just do what I do, do what I want to do, and not to have to worry so much about getting. I like getting.
No.
I like receiving, but it's just not my department to engineer that very much.
You know, Charles, many people are afraid of doing what they love. And one of the biggest reasons is their feeling of responsibility to their family, especially when they have kids. I find that in many cases, kids kind of hold us back from truly
yeah.
experiencing life and taking risks, and because we feel responsible for providing to our kids the best we can. And
yeah.
your example just shows that it is possible to take risks even with kids, and I'm sure your kids benefited from this transformation you went through also very much.
Yes. I mean, I think most people know that ultimately what is best for themselves will also end up being best for their children, and that their desire for their children's well-being is automatically incorporated into their decisions. But I want to also... I don't want this gift orientation or living in the gift or not doing things for the purpose of money. I don't want this to become like some heroic goal that you have to achieve it. You have to do it right now in order to be happy or in order to be virtuous or admirable, you know. I think that we are given opportunities that are just at the edge of our courage
mm-hmm.
to take a step toward toward where we want to go. And that when the time comes that a transition is necessary that's beyond our courage to consciously choose, then the universe in its ultimate generosity will make us do what we didn't have the courage to choose to do. So if it's, say, a job that's no longer serving you, then, and you just, but it's like, oh, but I have, I need the insurance, you know, I need the benefits and my children and this and this and this, and I just can't, I just can't quit it, you know, even though it's killing my soul, I cannot quit this job. I'm afraid to, I'm too afraid. Oh, but I'm torturing myself because I should quit it, you know, because I'm not living my life purpose, but I'm afraid to, and I've got to make myself do it, but, you know, and this can turn into this self-torture. And in that situation, I would suggest to realize when I'm ready, I will have the courage to quit this job. And either that or something will happen that I no longer will be able to do this job. You know, you get fired, you get sick, something happens, it just doesn't work. Like that's what happened to me. You know, nothing worked. When I was trying to be a success and promote myself, everything went wrong. I was not allowed to continue doing that, basically. But I don't want people to feel panicked or to feel that what I've done is something that's unattainable for them. It was, you know, I had a lot of help doing it. I was forced into doing it. It was because it's not that I'm more noble or more courageous than anybody out there. It's truly that I was born and I did 1% of the work myself. And the other 99% was my unconscious or the universe conspiring to birth me into this state. And that's the way it happens. You're in a world and you grow within that world and you have fears that protect you and keep you in that world. And then eventually when you grow up against its limits, the fears that were once protective become confining. And then you're born. You get propelled into a new world. It's very natural and no cause for self-torture.
Now, I value Charles Eisenstein's emphasis on money and giving and receiving, because for so many people, especially in the developed world, money seems to be the criterion which prevents them from living the life that they'd like to live. Now, I'm not thinking so much about the stereotype lazy bums who want to spend all day on the couch consuming things and not get a job. I'm thinking more, probably the people who listen to this show have a head full of ideas and a heart full of ambition to help their fellow man and to do constructive, creative things, but they have rent to pay or food to buy, and so being able to do those things requires money. And in the world to come, we're going to have to stop thinking of financial independence as a sine qua non, a kind of rite of passage. So even if a father demands that his son take demeaning, soul-destroying work because he's making him financially independent, according to one value system, he's doing him a good turn. Now that, in the future, has got to go. Now, let's hear from Karn Ross, the chap I first came across listening to a John Pilger film, The War You Don't See, and he's speaking to Ted in 2010.
My story is a little bit about war. It's about disillusionment, it's about death, and it's about rediscovering idealism in all of that wreckage. And perhaps also there's a lesson about how to deal with our screwed up, fragmenting and dangerous world of the 21st century. I don't believe in straightforward narratives. I don't believe in a life or history written as decision A led to consequence B, led to consequence C, these neat narratives that we're presented with and that perhaps we encourage in each other. I believe in randomness, and one of the reasons I believe that is because me becoming a diplomat was random. I'm colorblind. I was born unable to see most colors. This is why I wear gray and black most of the time, and I have to take my wife with me to choose clothes. I'd always wanted to be a fighter pilot when I was a boy. I loved watching planes barrel over our holiday home in the countryside. And it was my boyhood dream to be a fighter pilot. And I did the test in the Royal Air Force to become a pilot. And sure enough, I failed. I couldn't see all the blinking different lights. I can't distinguish colour. So I had to choose another career. And this was, in fact, relatively easy for me because I had an abiding passion all the way through my childhood, which was international relations. As a child, I read the newspaper thoroughly. I was fascinated by the Cold War, by the INF negotiations over intermediate-range nuclear missiles, the proxy war between the Soviet Union and the US in Angola or Afghanistan. These things really interested me. And so I decided at quite an early age I wanted to be a diplomat, and One day, I announced this to my parents, and my father denies this story to this day. I said, "Daddy, I want to be a diplomat." And he turned to me and he said, "Khan, you have to be very clever to be a diplomat." And my ambition was sealed. 1989, I entered the British Foreign Service. That year, 5,000 people applied to become a diplomat, and 20 of us succeeded. And as those numbers suggest, I was inducted into an elite and fascinating and exhilarating world. Being a diplomat then and now is an incredible job, and I loved every minute of it. I enjoyed the status of it. I bought myself a nice suit and wore leather-soled shoes and reveled in this amazing access I had to world events. I traveled to the Gaza Strip. I headed the Middle East Peace Process section in the British Foreign Ministry. I became speechwriter for the British Foreign Secretary. I met Yasser Arafat. I negotiated with Saddam's diplomats at the UN. Later, I traveled to Kabul and served in Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban. And I would travel in a C-130 transport and go and visit warlords in mountain hideaways and negotiate with them about how we were going to eradicate al-Qaeda from Afghanistan, surrounded by my special forces escort, who themselves had to have an escort of a platoon of Royal Marines because it was so dangerous. And that was exciting. That was fun. It was really interesting. And it's a great cadre of people, incredibly close-knit community of people. And the pinnacle of my career, as it turned out, was when I was posted to New York. I'd already served in Germany, Norway, various other places. But I was posted to New York to serve on the UN Security Council for the British delegation, and my responsibility was the Middle East, which was my speciality. And there I dealt with things like the Middle East peace process, the Lockerbie issue — we can talk about that later if you wish. But above all, my responsibility was Iraq and its weapons of mass destruction and the sanctions we placed on Iraq to oblige it to disarm itself of these weapons. I was the chief British negotiator on this subject, and I was steeped in the issue. And my tour, it was kind of a very exciting time. I mean, it was very, very dramatic diplomacy. We went through several wars during my time in New York. I negotiated for my country the resolution in the Security Council of the 12th of September 2001, condemning the attacks of the day before, which were, of course, deeply present to us, actually living in New York at the time. So it was kind of a best of times, worst of times kind of experience. I lived the high life. I had, although I worked very long hours, I lived in a penthouse in Union Square. I was a single British diplomat in New York City. You can imagine what that might have meant. I had a good time. But in 2002, when my tour came to an end, I decided I wasn't going to go back to the job that was waiting for me in London. I decided to take a sabbatical, in fact, at the New School, Bruce. I, in some inchoate, inarticulate way, I realized that there was something wrong with my work, with me. I was exhausted, and I was also disillusioned in a way I couldn't quite put my finger on. And I decided to take some time out from work. The Foreign Office was very generous. You could take these special unpaid leave, as they call them, and yet remain part of the diplomatic service but not actually do any work. It was nice. And eventually I decided to take a secondment to join the UN in Kosovo, which was then under UN administration. And two things happened in Kosovo which kind of, again, shows the randomness of life, because these things turned out to be two of the pivots of my life and helped deliver me to the next stage. But they were random things. One was that in the summer of 2004, the British government somewhat reluctantly decided to have an official inquiry into the use of intelligence on WMD in the run-up to the Iraq war, a very limited subject. And I testified to that inquiry in secret. I had been steeped in the intelligence on Iraq and its WMD, and my testimony to the inquiry said three things, that the government exaggerated the intelligence, which was very clear in all the years I'd read it, and indeed our own internal assessment was very clear, that Iraq's WMD did not pose a threat to its neighbors, let alone to us. Secondly, the government had ignored all available alternatives to war, which in some ways was a more discreditable thing still. The third reason I won't go into. But anyway, I gave that testimony, and that presented me with a crisis. What was I going to do? This testimony was deeply critical of my colleagues, of my ministers, who had, in my view, perpetrated a war on a falsehood. And so I was in crisis. And this wasn't a pretty thing. I moaned about it. I hesitated. I went on and on and on to my long-suffering wife. And eventually, I decided to resign from the British Foreign Service. I felt there's a scene in the Al Pacino movie, The Insider, which you may know, where he goes back to CBS after they've let him down over the tobacco guy. And he goes, you know, I just can't do this anymore. Something's broken. And it was like that for me. I love that movie. I felt just something's broken. I can't actually sit with my foreign minister or my prime minister again with a smile on my face and do what I used to do gladly for them. So I took a running leap and jumped over the edge of a cliff. And it was a very, very uncomfortable, unpleasant feeling. And I started to fall. And today, that fall hasn't stopped. I'm still falling. But in a way, I've got used to the sensation of it. And in a way, I kind of like the sensation of it a lot better than I liked actually standing on top of the cliff wondering what to do. A second thing happened in Kosovo, which kind of delivered the answer, which I couldn't really answer, which is, what do I do with my life? I love diplomacy. I have no career. I expected my entire life to be a diplomat, to be serving my country. I wanted to be an ambassador. My mentors, my heroes, were people who got to the top of my profession, and here I was throwing it all away. A lot of my friends were still in it. My pension was in it, and I gave it up. And what was I going to do? And that year in Kosovo, this terrible, terrible thing happened, which I saw. In March 2004, there were terrible riots all over the province, as it then was, of Kosovo. 18 people were killed. It was anarchy. And it's a very horrible thing to see anarchy, to know that the police and the military, there were lots of NATO troops there, actually can't stop that rampaging mob who's coming down the street. And the only way that rampaging mob coming down the street will stop is when they decide to stop and when they've had enough burning and killing. And that is not a very nice feeling to see. And I saw it and I went through it. I went through those mobs. And with my Albanian friends, we tried to stop it, but we failed. And that riot taught me something, which isn't immediately obvious. And it's kind of a complicated story. But one of the reasons that riot took place, those riots, which went on for several days, took place was because the Kosovo people were disenfranchised from their own future. There were diplomatic negotiations about the future of Kosovo going on then, and the Kosovo government, let alone the Kosovo people, were not actually participating in those talks. There was this whole fancy diplomatic system, this negotiation process about the future of Kosovo, and the Kosovars weren't part of it. And funnily enough, they were frustrated about that. And those riots were part of the manifestation of that frustration. It wasn't the only reason, and life is not simple one reason narratives. It was a complicated thing, and I'm not pretending it was more simple than it was, but that was one of the reasons. And that kind of gave me the inspiration, or rather, to be precise, it gave my wife the inspiration. She said, why don't you advise the Kosovars? Why don't you advise their government on their diplomacy? And the Kosovars were not allowed a diplomatic service. They were not allowed diplomats. They were not allowed a foreign office to help them deal with this immensely complicated process, which became known as the final status process of Kosovo. And so that was the idea. That was the origin of the thing that became Independent Diplomat, the world's first diplomatic advisory group and a non-profit to boot. And it began when I flew back from London after my time at the UN in Kosovo. I flew back and had dinner with the Kosovo Prime Minister and said to him, look, I'm proposing that I come and advise you on the diplomacy. I know this stuff. This is what I do. Why don't I come and help you? And he said, raised his glass of raki to me and said, yes, come. And I came to Kosovo and advised the Kosovo government. Independent Diplomat ended up advising three successive Kosovo prime ministers and the multi-party negotiation team of Kosovo. And Kosovo became independent. Independent Diplomat is now established in 5 diplomatic centers around the world, and we're advising 7 or 8 different countries or political groups, depending how you wish to define them, and I'm not big on definitions. We're advising the Northern Cypriots on how to reunify their island. We're advising the Burmese opposition, the government of Southern Sudan, which you heard it here first, is going to be a new country within the next few years. We're advising the Polisario Front of the Western Sahara, who are fighting to get their country back from Moroccan occupation after 34 years of dispossession. We're advising various island states in the climate change negotiations, which is supposed to culminate in Copenhagen. There's a bit of randomness here too, because when I was beginning Independent Diplomat, I went to a party in the House of Lords, which is a ridiculous place, but I was holding my drink like this, and I bumped into this guy who was standing behind me. We started talking, and he said, I told him what I was doing, and I told him rather grandly I was going to establish Independent Diplomat in New York. At that time, there was just me and my wife were moving back to New York. And he said, oh, why don't you see my colleagues in New York? And it turned out he worked for an innovation company called What If, which some of you have probably heard of. And one thing led to another. And I ended up having a desk in What If in New York when I started Independent Diplomat. And watching What If develop new flavors of chewing gum for Wrigley or new flavors for Coke actually helped me innovate new strategies for the Kosovars and for the Sahrawis of the Western Sahara. And I began to realize that there are different ways of doing diplomacy. That diplomacy, like business, is a business of solving problems. And yet the word innovation doesn't exist in diplomacy. It's all zero-sum games and realpolitik and ancient institutions that have been there for generations and do things the same way they've always done things. And Independent Diplomat today tries to incorporate some of the things I learned at What If. We all sit in one office and shout at each other across the office. We all work on little laptops and try to move desks to change the way we think. And we use naive experts who may know nothing about the countries we're dealing with, but may know something about something else, to try to inject new thinking into the problems that we try to address for our clients. It's not easy, because our clients, by definition, are having a difficult time diplomatically. There are, I don't know, some lessons from all of this, personal and political, and in a way they're the same thing. The personal one is falling off a cliff is actually a good thing, and I recommend it. And it's a good thing to do at least once in your life, just to tear everything up and jump. The second thing is a bigger lesson about the world today. Independent Diplomat is part of a trend which is emerging and evident across the world, which is that the world is fragmenting. States mean less than they used to. The power of the state is declining. That means the power of other things is rising. Those other things are called non-state actors. They may be corporations. They may be mafiosi. They may be nice NGOs. They may be anything, any number of things. We are living in a more complicated and fragmented world. If governments are less able to affect the problems that affect us in the world, then that means who is left to deal with them? Who has to take greater responsibility to deal with them? Us. If they can't do it, who's left to deal with it? We have no choice but to embrace that reality. What this means is it's no longer good enough to say that international relations or global affairs or chaos in Somalia or what's going on in Burma is none of your business, and that you can leave it to governments to get on with. I can connect any one of you by 6 degrees of separation to the Al-Shabaab militia in Somalia. Ask me how later, particularly if you eat fish, interestingly enough. But that connection is there. We are all intimately connected, and this isn't just Tom Friedman. It's actually provable in case after case after case. What that means is, instead of asking your politicians to do things, you have to look to yourself to do things. An Independent Diplomat is a kind of example of this in a sort of loose way, and there aren't neat examples, but one example is this. The way the world is changing is embodied in what's going on at the place I used to work, the UN Security Council. The UN was established in 1945. Its charter is basically designed to stop conflicts between states, interstate conflict. Today, 80% of the agenda of the UN Security Council is about conflicts within states, involving non-state parties, guerrillas, separatists, terrorists, if you want to call them that, people who are not normal governments, who are not normal states. That is the state of the world today. When I realized this, and when I look back on my time at the Security Council and what happened with the Kosovars, and I realized that often the people who were most directly affected by what we were doing in the Security Council weren't actually there, weren't actually invited to give their views to the Security Council, I thought, this is wrong. Something's got to be done about this. So I started off in a traditional mode. Me and my colleagues, an independent diplomat, went round the UN Security Council. We went round 70 UN member states, the Kazakhs, the Ethiopians, the Israelis, you name them. We went to see them, the Secretary General, all of them, and said, this is all wrong. This is terrible that you don't consult these people who are actually affected. You've got to institutionalize a system where you actually invite the Kosovars to come and tell you what they think. This would allow you to tell, you can tell them what you think. It would be great. You can have an exchange. You can actually incorporate these people's views into your decisions, which means your decisions will be more effective and durable. Super logical, you would think. I mean, incredibly logical. So obvious, anybody could get it. And of course, everybody got it. Everybody went, yes, of course, you're absolutely right. Come back to us in, you know, maybe 6 months. And of course, nothing happened. Nobody did anything. The Security Council does its business in exactly the same way today that it did X number of years ago when I was there 10 years ago. So we looked at that observation of basically failure and thought, what can we do about it? And I thought, I'm buggered if I'm going to spend the rest of my life lobbying for these crummy governments to do what needs to be done. So what we're going to do is we're actually going to set up these meetings ourselves. So now Independent Diplomat is in the process of setting up meetings between the UN Security Council and the parties to the disputes that are on the agenda of the Security Council. So we will be bringing Darfuri rebel groups, the Northern Cypriots and the Southern Cypriots, rebels from Aceh, an awful long laundry list of chaotic conflicts around the world, and we will be trying to bring the parties to New York to sit down in a quiet room in a private setting with no press and actually explain what they want to the members of the UN Security Council and for the members of the UN Security Council to explain to them what they want. So there's actually a conversation which has never before happened. And of course, describing all this, any of you who know politics will think this is incredibly difficult, and I entirely agree with you. The chances of failure are very high, but it certainly won't happen if we don't try to make it happen. And my politics has changed fundamentally from when I was a diplomat to what I am today, and I think the outputs is what matters, not process, not technology, frankly, so much either. Preach technology to all the twittering members of the Iranian demonstrations who are now in political prison in Tehran, where Ahmadinejad remains in power. Technology has not delivered political change in Iran. You've got to look at the outputs, and you've got to say to yourself, what can I do to produce that particular output? That is the politics of the 21st century. And in a way, an independent diplomat embodies that fragmentation, that change that is happening to all of us. That's my story.
I hope this show has encouraged you and helped you to hear your own inner calling. It's been more than 6 months now since I've been making these shows, and I don't regret my change from amateur computer programmer to amateur radio programmer. Thanks to all of you for listening, and thanks to those who've been in touch, who've given feedback, made suggestions for material for future shows, or who've otherwise contributed. Thanks also to Teresa Caraggio for producing our 10th anniversary show, and of course a special thanks to the founder of the Unwelcome Guests Collective and creator of more than 500 past shows, Lynn Gerry. Those and all our previous shows are available for download at unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Let us keep straining to hear the inner calling and to give all we can to help others to hear their calling. The rich will come down.